From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
You know, I think it was a good idea that the governor called this meeting. The progress that was made was that the Democratic leaders agreed to make their appointments to the budgeteering process, and they also agreed that we would certify a number for revenues. So two important critical steps.
That hasn't been done in years. That's the law, that's what we should do, is agree on a revenue number, and we got the leaders to agree to do that. So that was good progress today.
Well, the process will be much easier because the governor is assuming a lot more money than we had in the past. He's assuming that the tax increase that he vetoed is obviously needed. That's why it was included in his budget. That's why he wants us to start with that number now. So that's a big help.
You know what? Illinoisans will spend it, but we have to be wise with our spending. And I think the goal is that we need to scale back. We don't need to spend everything. That's the money which we'll certify, but that's part of the negotiation process and which party has best interests of taxpayers in mind. And hopefully the Democrats will agree with it.
Well, legislative leaders met with the governor this week, and they discussed getting a state budget done. Can they do that this spring? Will there be one at all? This is normally the time we start to see these negotiations pick up steam. We'll talk more about that on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler. Charlie runs the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Also joining me in studio, Daisy Contreras, our IPR Statehouse reporter, and Brian Mackey is in our Statehouse Bureau. He's IPR Statehouse reporter there, and joined by Doug Finke, our guest this week. Doug covers the Statehouse beat for the State Journal Register. And Doug, good to have you on once again.
Thanks for having me.
And Brian and Doug, we talked about this meeting that took place in the governor's office. Was there any progress made toward reaching some type of budget agreement?
Well, I mean, a little bit, I guess you would say. It's early April. You're not expecting any kind of breakthroughs from these kind of meetings. But the fact that they did all get together and it didn't end in disharmony is certainly progress. And both sides agreed to a couple of things when it comes to the budget. One, they're going to each caucus is going to appoint negotiators to work on the budget behind the scenes and try to come up with some common ground. And two, they agreed to set a revenue estimate for the upcoming fiscal year and use that as the basis for going forward. Because before you can decide how much you have to spend, you need to decide how much money you have available to spend. So from that sense, it was some progress.
Although I would say, add to that, a low bar for progress, though, right? These are things that are supposed to happen in normal circumstances.
If you want to set a low bar, the governor said he wants a budget this year that doesn't have a tax increase, and I'd say it's a pretty fair bet that the lawmakers are not going to come back and pass a tax increase in an election year.
But yeah, should have no problem pole vaulting the governor's demands for this budget year, although you never know. One of the interesting takeaways I thought that came out of that meeting, as Doug said, no, it did not seem to end in any sort of apparent discord, although the House Speaker left through a back door and avoided the media, but immediately issued a two-paragraph statement that seems to have probably been pre-written, given the dispatch with which it landed in our inboxes, sort of criticizing the governor's past, you know, holding elderly and disabled people hostage, the same sort of rhetoric we've heard from the speaker for quite a while now, but also, as he has done, pledging to work cooperatively if the governor wants to do that to address the budget problems. But one of the other interesting takeaways is, as Senate President John Cullerton pointed out, you know, this is once again the governor signaling that he is willing and perhaps even eager to spend the money that the tax increase brought in, even as he is still campaigning against that tax increase. And the other Republicans, we heard Jim Durkin right there at the top of the show very quickly say, yeah, we'll spend it, but blah, 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 blah. We want to restrain spending and so forth. So an acknowledgement, even as people are campaigning against last year's tax increase, that revenue is necessary to balance Illinois' budget.
Well, Charlie, we mentioned there the, you know, a low bar for progress. I guess things could be worse, and we've seen budget negotiations many times go off the rails in April, early May, and they, things come back together. But this is a different feeling. There's just so much uncertainty because the inability for these folks to work together through the years. You're just not sure what's going to take place here. So everybody's a bit cautious right now, it seems to be.
Yeah, and I was thinking as Doug and Brian were talking about this progress, and recalling back in the days when I was an active reporter back in the Stone Age, that would be progress the same way that I got up this morning and I looked outside. Oh my gosh, the sun rose in the east today. It was just taken for granted that you would do these kinds of things. But, you know, in recent years, we've not been following what I had long thought was sort of the agreed-upon norm. So the fact that they've met, the fact that they are going to adopt a revenue estimate, they're going to try and conform the spending to it, that's good. The difficulty is there are real problems with the budget that the governor proposed because he's got, what, for want of a better term, you could say wishful thinking embedded in it. For example, he's talking about shifting some of the pension costs from the state to local school districts and to universities. And already a majority of the House members have said, we're not going to do this. And even in the Republican caucus, members have said, no, we're not going to do this because it would hurt our school districts. We'd have to raise property taxes. The fact is the money has to come from somewhere. And you shift it from the state and put it on the local governments, then they have to come up with the funds somewhere. So that's not going to fly. And that's what? That's $600, $700 million hole right there. And the governor is also counting on savings from a pension plan that has yet to be approved. And there's no certainty that were it to be approved and signed by the governor, the Supreme Court would go along with it. So there's a lot of uncertainty, and there are going to be some tough decisions to be made going forward. And I'll also predict right now the budget will not be balanced in the sense that we end the fiscal year with a surplus because of the old bills that we have, because of the multi-billion dollar deficit that's going to be carried forward or that is now carried forward. We just won't be able to come out with a surplus at the end of the year.
Well, I know going into an election year, there's not a lot of ideas that are new ideas that are brought to the table quite often. It's, nobody wants to do anything too radical as we head toward the election. But at the same time, have we heard anything, like you mentioned, the governor's pension shift idea? Have we heard that anything else could be on the table? Anybody heard anything regarding what might be talked about in the budget, at least even behind closed doors?
I nothing too creative or exciting. Like you said, Sean, this is an election year. I think people are eager to get out of here with as little attention as possible and get back to campaigning on the message they want to campaign on. There's not much good news that comes out of talking about the Illinois budget these days, and it's not something people want to, I think, try and make a name for themselves on right now. I will say, just to clarify a point Charlie had made, you know, I think the governor, these pension savings, and he's talked about tying that to a tax cut. Democrats have actually credited him for not counting on that in this year's budget. This is something that he has kind of said this tax cut would only come, you know, and these savings would only be be reflected if this thing was passed. And so he didn't sort of cook the books in a way that he and other governors have done by proposing savings that were sort of fantasies in terms of that. I mean, there are other things, this pension cost shift, making local school districts pay for pensions.
There's also the health insurance changes.
Which has been a perennial thing and bipartisan budgets now, which the union contract has been stalled for going on 3-4 years now, and that's being fought in court. The union seems to be waiting out the governor. There's one thing we haven't talked about that I think the governor was trying to achieve this week, and at least based on the media coverage, he seems to have done it, which is making himself appear relevant to the budget process again. After what happened last summer, where he was basically sidelined, he vetoed the budget, he vetoed the tax hike, and 16 Republicans said enough with this 2-year impasse and bucked him in order to help Democrats pass a budget and tax hike and end the impasse. And so the governor began the week with a news conference kind of laying out his agenda for the legislative session. And it occurs to me that, like, we're more than halfway through the spring. Now, there's, you know, we have not had half of our legislative days yet, but we're coming up on the sort of the midpoint of the session days where the bills have to be House bills have to be passed from the House. Senate bills have to be passed from the Senate. This is a little bit like, you know, a student saying how great he was going to do in school this year, but not saying it until like December when the midterms were coming up. So, but, you know, the governor seems to want to project this view of being involved in this process, even as he is now leaving town for a couple of weeks to go on a trade mission to Europe.
Now, Doug, how important is it for the governor to get a budget done, to have lawmakers, whether or not they're in full agreement, to get something done and not have an impasse that drags out over the summer months and as we get closer to an election? Is it important for him politically?
Well, I think it's important for him politically, but I don't think it's unimportant for the legislature to have it done. You know, I've asked various observers about who would gain politically from an impasse, and mostly the reaction I've gotten is that nobody. And so there's an impetus for the governor and the lawmakers to get something done, get it done on time, even if they're not, either side is entirely happy with the final product. You know, and there's also the discussion that's been going around about whether the legislature would just pass like a half-year budget to get the state past the election and then come back, presumably with a Democratic governor and Democratic majorities in the House and Senate and finish the job. But I've also, in talking to people, there seems to be, even Democrats are not wild about that idea, because even if they assume that J.B. Pritzker is going to get elected governor, there's a kind of a feeling that I sense that they don't want him to immediately come in and face a budget crisis and have to deal with that right off the bat.
And gridlock and the inability to get things done. Daisy, that doesn't reflect well on anybody.
Right, yeah. And I mean, even now, Rauner, his wish list hasn't really changed that much from past years. He still wants, like it's been said earlier, teacher pension cuts, term limits, better tax credit programs for businesses. But at the same time, yes, the General Assembly would also benefit from looking like they're actually working with the governor on this.
And Charlie, he certainly made himself relevant for a while in the budget process, as we saw the impasse that dragged out for so long. Last year, he was sort of cut out, it seemed, in the summer months when a few Republicans, decided to go ahead and help pass a tax increase and get a budget in place. Any indication that you're hearing anything that these Republicans are willing to, you know, break with the governor again if it comes down to that? Or, you know, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, it occurs to me that it wasn't so much the Republicans who voted for the budget, the tax increase, and the overrides breaking with the governor as much as it was they were standing up for their constituents. They had to make a choice between following the governor's hard line and holding out and starving human services to try and get his anti-union agenda through, or supporting their local human service programs back home, their educational institutions, all the folks in their districts who rely on state funding, and they chose to go with their districts, which in the long run shouldn't really be a surprise, because that's the way it's supposed to work. And it occurs to me that those very same Republicans, many of whom aren't on the ballot in November, they're going to retire when this 100th General Assembly ends in January of 2019. They're, in a sense, free agents. They can go ahead and vote their conscience again. So it seems to me that the chances of us getting a full-year budget are really very strong, either with the governor's cooperation or with the governor kind of shunted aside.
And Brian, before we move on to other topics, I'm going to give you kind of the last word on this, but aren't Republicans, those who may have voted for a tax increase before, even if they are leaving office, don't you think they might want something to sort of have, you know, build on their legacy of their time in office to say, hey, if I'm going to go ahead and vote for another budget with you, you know, I've got to get something. I mean, it seems to me that it's not going to be an easy process here moving forward the next several weeks.
No, I think that you're right. I think those Republicans who crossed over last summer do have some more leverage. And I think we saw an example of that this week in that Jim Durkin, the House Republican leader, who is closely aligned himself with Governor Rauner and was also one of the people who was gone against last year when there was that Republican revolt. He appointed one of the revolutionaries, so to speak, State Representative David Harris from the suburb of Arlington Heights. He appointed him to be one of the budget negotiators. So I think there is an attempt among Republicans to keep those people somewhat inside the tent, so to speak, and to try and in talking to them, in talking to Harris, and talking to Representative Chad Hayes, and talking to Steve Anderson this week, they all say they want the governor. They hope the governor will be a part of this process and that things can get resolved in a more normal fashion.
And Brian and Doug, let's move on to some to show a little bit of the impact that budget impasse has had. We're still seeing some state agencies struggling to support themselves, pay bills, things like that, very far behind in some cases. And that's certainly the case with the Department of Corrections. The state prison system has a need for quite a bit of money here. They're looking for a supplemental budget, additional money that would be allotted to them this fiscal year to pay some of the debts that they owe. Give us sort of the update on where that stands and what's the likelihood they might see that money.
Yeah, this was something that there was a big Senate hearing this week. It's something that has been known for a while. It was a discussion during last summer's budget negotiations. The governor, in fact, criticized the legislature for not including some of this money. Democrats say the problem here is that they did pass enough money to keep corrections operating in 2018. In the budget year 2018. The problem is the Department of Corrections used some of that money to pay off expenses they incurred during the budget impasse. And they've never had, when that money was never approved. But the Rauner administration still signed contracts and still, ordered food and toilet paper for the prisons and power and water to keep them going. And so that's one of the criticisms in why this has become sort of a political fight. There's a couple other dynamics here, though. The prisons are really struggling. They've had vendors back out. They almost had the water shut off at Western Correctional Center. That was a couple year and a half ago. But still, this is something where they are really having to scrimp by. They said they cannot afford to wait through the normal budget-making process, which had Senate Democrats wondering, why is this the first time we're coming to you? State Senator Andy Menar, who's one of the budget chairmen in the Senate, said to the prison director, "We've never met before. This is the first time you're talking to me about this. Why, you're treating this like it's a normal budget request when you ought to be raising a five-alarm fire and really sort of conveying the urgency of the situation here." Menar said he had heard from more inmates than he had, more from inmates about the need for a supplemental appropriation for corrections than he had from corrections officials themselves.
Not to defend corrections up and down the line, but to be fair, Rauner's budget director in early February testified before the some of these same Senate Appropriations Committee members and said that they needed a supplemental appropriation at that time for both Medicaid, and corrections. And the budget director was asked at that time, what's going to how soon it was going to be a problem for corrections if they didn't get the supplemental, and he said back then, very soon. So the idea that this comes as a surprise to the Democrats, I think, is not exactly correct.
It occurs to me, too, that in defense of the department, they were in a situation that something as basic to the well-being of the prisoners is having toilet paper available. They couldn't wait around. They had these contracts that they entered into because they had to provide these services to the people who are incarcerated. So they couldn't wait around for the General Assembly to act and for the governor to sign it. In ideal conditions, we wouldn't have had a budget impasse. We would have had all these things taken care of in the normal order. But in extraordinary times, I think the correction department did what they had to do.
I think that both Doug and Charlie are right. This is something that has really become part of the political football between Democrats and the governor. And you go back to the budget impasse. The governor said, you know, I'm doing the best I can to manage the state. And the Democratic idea was they want the governor to come on bended knee and say, you know what, you guys were right. We really need this budget. Let's pass a budget. And they never did that. The governor never did that, certainly. And so this is just you know, the corrections is sort of caught in the middle of this. You know, ideally, the Democrats would like to see the governor come in and say, like I said, you guys were right. We should have had this budget. Come, please, can we have some extra money? Because I couldn't do it without you guys. But that's not going to happen here. And so corrections officials are trying to do the best they can. And the director did say he wanted to credit his staff for working under extraordinarily difficult circumstances. And you can imagine not having any money to spend makes it pretty difficult. I mean, he had described this situation where they had the buses lined up outside Western Correctional Center, ready to take 1,500 prisoners elsewhere because they thought the water was about to be shut off.
Now, some non-budget action did take place this week at the Capitol. In the state Senate, Daisy, the ERA passed the state Senate. This is not the first time that has happened. A lot of people may be wondering, okay, just what does this mean? Okay, so this has passed the state Senate, still has to go through the House, but even if it passes there, does it mean anything?
Right, it's more of a symbolic vote. This renews a push that's decades old, almost 36 years old, that would guarantee that rights can't be denied because of a person's sex. Back when it was first going on, 38 states were needed to ratify this before the 1982 deadline, but only 35 did. So if Illinois and two other states ratify this now, advocates believe they have a chance at pushing Congress to extend the deadline. So that's why it's symbolic.
Charlie, you've been covering this for quite a long time, of course, going back to when it was even more controversial, getting so much attention at the Illinois Capitol. What do you make of the latest push for it?
Well, I would amend what you said because I was covering it before it was even controversial in the least, because it's included in our own Constitution, mm-hmm. in the Bill of Rights, virtually identical language as the proposed federal amendment. And when the ConCon delegates put that in the Constitution, and it wasn't in the 1871, it was added, something new, in the 1970 Constitution, there was no big hubbub, there were no opposition rallies, there were no people chaining themselves to the House doors. All of this occurred when the federal amendment came out, and we had probably some of the most colorful demonstrations ever. I alluded to some ERA supporters, a group of women who literally chained themselves to the House, to the doors of the Illinois House, the ceremonial doors at the front of the chamber. We had periodically, when the ERA was up for a vote and they were ready to call the resolution, the fire alarms would sound and we'd have to empty the building. There were a group of women who were opposing it who would bake pies and bring them down to the rotunda, and as lawmakers came in, they would give them slices of home-baked pie, the idea being that women's place was in the kitchen baking pies and not out agitating for equal rights. So, yeah, I've seen a lot of it. And the legislature on past occasions, both the House and the Senate, did approve the federal ERA, but they never did it in the same legislative session so that it would become effective. And with the changes that have gone on, I think Daisy's right. This is now largely symbolic. We already have these protections in Illinois, and it's more symbolism than it is anything that's going to cause any real changes.
And I did hear from some supporters who had said that, well, yes, maybe it won't have a huge mm-hmm. impact in Illinois, but there are some other states that may not have those same protections, and getting this included into the U.S. Constitution, right, if they can actually make that happen, that it could help people in those states. But go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, and adding to what Charlie said, with the Me Too movement going on now and sexual harassment controversies everywhere, including the state capitol, many think that it can pass out of both chambers. Passed out of the Senate, now it goes to the House, and they think that now there's enough support and the movement is strong enough to get it approved at the same time in both chambers.
Well, and there's another angle too, because a lot of states rushed to ratify it immediately after it was presented. Illinois was the only northern state that did not. Most of the others that wouldn't are kind of in the old Confederacy. But since then, there's been talk about, can we rescind our ratification? And in some of the states that are more conservative, it occurs to me there might be a move afoot to try and rescind it. And is that going to be allowed? Will Congress allow a state that has voted to ratify an amendment to the federal Constitution to later rescind that ratification?
Also, Daisy, you covered this week. There's been a lot of discussion at the federal level over what's known as net neutrality. A lot of people may not know what that is, but you can explain that for us. And what is going on here in Illinois? What are they trying to do about it?
So the FCC last December voted to get rid of this so-called net neutrality protections that basically make all websites the same. An internet service provider can't say one website can run faster than another, so every website, every service is treated the same. So once April 23rd comes around, these net neutrality protections are gone at the federal level. So what states are trying to do now is enact their own protections so that internet service providers follow these rules. In Illinois, the legislation that's being proposed right now is that internet service providers would either pledge to follow net neutrality rules, or they have to disclose to their customers that they're not following net neutrality protections because individual states are not allowed to regulate the internet. That's up to the FCC.
So a little more transparency in that respect. All right. Well,
so how would Illinois get around that in this?
So as long as they're not stopping internet service providers from getting away from net neutrality, they're okay. So they're not allowed to regulate how they operate, as long as the only thing that this is saying is that they have to disclose that they're not following net neutrality.
All right, time now for our notes from the field. And Brian, let's start with you.
Yeah, I happened to be trolling through some state government reports, and I stumbled on the Office of the Architect of the Capitol's annual report. And in a nod, I guess, to complete government transparency, they reported the amount of money collected from the fountains on the east lawn of the Capitol. In the last 10 fiscal years, Illinois has gotten $569.86 from the fountain. So memo to the budgeteers, there's some money that's probably available for sweeping to help balance the budget.
All right. And Doug, let's go to you.
Speaking of supplemental appropriations, there was a bill that got out of a Senate Appropriations Committee to authorize payment back wages to thousands of state workers. This dates back to the Quinn administration when he withheld some raises they were supposed to get. This bill is a long way from actually being enacted, but at least they got the step going.
All right. And Daisy?
So there is legislation that would allow pharmacists to prescribe or dispense birth control to anyone. There's no age restriction without a doctor's prescription, and that will be discussed in the House. Some medical groups are actually supporting this, and it's more from the opposition, conservative groups that don't want younger kids having access to birth control.
And we also want to also congratulate the U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth. She gave birth to her second daughter this week. She is the first sitting member of the U.S. Senate to give birth while in office. That will do it for State Week. Members of our broadcast today include Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, Daisy Contreras, and also our guest, Doug Finke. You can get a podcast of our show. It's available at nprillinois.org and also find us on NPR One. Just look for State Week. The production assistance for the program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.